We have four different matters that were consolidated for argument. I'm going to be calling it 85193, Nevins versus Martin, but I recognize there were appeals and cross appeals going on in this case. And Justice Bell she's recused herself and she won't be participating in this case. With that being said, and with both sides being appellate, so both sides will have the opportunity to reserve some time. I also just want to mention, because it's something new that we're trying this month, is each side gets 20 minutes total for their argument, but we also are giving an additional 2 minutes per side to have an initial 2 minutes uninterrupted during your argument. So apparently the United States Supreme Court has been trying that and it's been well received, so we decided to give it a try. So we will discipline ourselves to let you have your 2 minutes. With that, counsel, how much time would you like to reserve?
Madam Chief Justice, may I please reserve 2 minutes?
Sure. And you may begin when you're ready.
Good afternoon, members of the court. My name is Ben Lusty, and with co-counsel Chelsea Hewitt, appearing on behalf of Dr. Nevins and the professional entities. As mentioned before, there are many issues consolidated on appeal. However, I contend that one issue, if ruled on, will resolve all issues, and that is the jury instruction which was given, advising the jury that they could presume negligence as against Dr. Nevins. We contend that was given in error, it was prejudicial, and it warrants vacating the verdict and therefore all associated orders and judgments which stemmed from that. In this 2 minutes, I'd like to focus first on that issue and then a couple other matters which I think are of key importance. NRS 41A-103 specifically precludes jury instructions allowing a presumption of negligence when the plaintiff retains an expert to opine as to the standard of care. That was the case. In this case, there was a plaintiff's expert who testified. Now, the district court mistakenly, in our view, concluded that it did not apply because the injury occurred in 2009 and the statute was added in 2015. However, if we look to this court's jurisprudence, it is apparent that the addition of this was a procedural statute or a procedural amendment because it went to the way the case was proven and the evidence which could be presented on appeal. Therefore, applying precedents such as Valdez and other similar cases, it should apply. And I would like to highlight in particular one case that this court decided recently, and that's Jaramillo versus Barnes, where this court said the presumption statute is an evidentiary procedural statute that applies at all stages, meaning if the plaintiff in presenting what is in effect a res ipsa case doesn't have to include an affidavit, they likewise don't have to have an expert to respond to a motion for summary judgment if they can rely on that. And I've used my whole uninterrupted 2 minutes on that one issue.
And counsel, I do have a question.
Several times in different orders, the court has referred to the instruction as saying both parties agree that it's not retroactive. The court made that statement twice. So I just want to start there. Did the parties, at least at the time, whether they're right or wrong, both agree that it was not retroactive?
So I think that takes us to the discussion which this court raised in Cook, which is what do you have to do to preserve a jury instruction? And in Cook, the plaintiff in that case said, well, I just don't think that the proposed instruction is a correct instruction. It was a mere happening instruction. And this court said, look, in the heat of the moment, you don't have to give a discourse on law. You don't have to state it with the precision as the brief writer. And in the heat of trial, so long as you identify the error, provide a cogent analysis as to why you contend it should or should not be given, that's going to preserve the instruction. Now, that was given in this case because trial counsel, Mr. Hall, specifically said, apply 41A-103. Now, the discussion about is this a retroactive, does it apply retroactively, is this court's recognized, I think, in Segovia and in Humboldt, that the 2015 amendment to NRS 41A had a lot of mixed components, some of which were certainly substantive, but some of which, especially in Zhang and Ferrelli, I think is how it should be said, were held to be either clarifying.
So that, but that's going to the discussion of how we would analyze. My question is, did the parties tell the court? Yeah, I think there's an objection certainly to it. Did the parties tell the court, we all agree it's not retroactive? But that's not mutually exclusive that you can't say I still object to you giving it for other grounds. I'm just trying to understand the reasons under which the court adopted that statement.
So certainly that word was said, not retroactive, no dispute. But then if you look at the internal logic of the objection itself, the Dr. Nevins certainly argued, I want you to give this instruction. I contend it applies, notwithstanding I recognize that this injury was in 2009 and this was amended in 2015 or 14, I believe. Now, that leads to another related, and this case really does have a lot of questions.
Let me pause you just quickly. You were referring to page 1350 of volume 9 at that point, the argument with respect to giving instruction 24, where you say it's unfair and prejudicial to the defense to allow plaintiff to have both a professional negligence and res ipsa claim. And that the lawyer says the amendment simply codified what everyone already knew. I'm not sure exactly whether that encompasses the procedural issue or are there other places in the record where that's elaborated on.
Yes, Your Honor. So that goes to one of the other canons that we cite, which is a clarification. I don't know if it's clarificatory. An amendment that clarifies a statute should be applied retroactively, regardless of when it's addressed. So that was certainly an argument which was, in my mind, clearly articulated, but as well as just simply saying, here's the statute that applies to the evidentiary burden that the plaintiff has, we think it should apply. I think that inherently opposes the procedural argument. Now, whether it's clarification, I think is also squarely presented and preserved.
Well, and if it is clarification, then it contradicts the statement that it isn't retroactive, because if it were merely clarifying, it would, in effect, apply retroactively. I mean, it's...
Right. I think that that's also a fair way to look at it. The way that this court has sometimes used the language retroactive and clarification and when it will give effect, I confess I'm not the best grammarian in the world and I don't always follow it. And so I look at more at, does it apply the statute to facts in the past, even though the statute had already, versus that. And I think that that's the correct way to look at that. Now,
because even on the same page, it says, statute was amended in 2015 and isn't retroactive. That's your side saying that.
That was said in the trial court below. Yes, I specifically recognize that. Now, but there are some other things, too, that come into play with that statute. And this is what was said in Humboldt and was also repeated in Segovia, which is that this statute is not just one thing. It's got a lot of different components, some of which were held not to apply retroactively, I think in Segovia, where physician's assistant was added to the definition of providers, but also certainly in Zhang, where it said, well, it was clarificatory to say that the statute always implied or would apply to the professional entities. And whether we want to call that specifically retroactive, it's still a saying, regardless of the fact that it was later amended specifically so to state, which is what Zhang specifically said, we're still going to apply, as the statute now says, back to these facts that arose in 2004, 2009.
What do you rely on then? Because it seems that what you're saying is, even if the statute isn't retroactive, it seems like what you argued then was that even if it wasn't retroactive, that was the law even before the statutory change. In other words, that you couldn't have both res ipsa and an expert going to the jury in the same case.
Right.
What do you base that on, that position that in fact was the law without the statutory change?
Well, if we go back to, on the hearings, there was in fact legislative history saying that if we allow, and the phrase that was used in the legislative debate was double dip. If we allow the double dip where the plaintiff gets both an instruction
as the basis for the legislature to make the change that doesn't apply retroactively.
Well, and they said that flies in the face of the law, thus implying and indicating that was never meant to be the law, that was never meant to be the way the district courts, the appellate courts, whomever, should not have interpreted the statute in this way. And we want to make sure and clarify that it was always intended to be that way. Now, if you, you know, if you're asking me, can I find an ancient common law case that says you can't have both, I confess I could not find it. But if we go back to what, you know, this court said back in the 40s in Gaffney, when it began articulating what res ipsa means, it says res ipsa is an evidentiary presumption. It's a way you plead and prove facts. If you have expert testimony, then you have no need of the res ipsa. But if we also go a step back further, the whole point of res ipsa, if we really want to go old school common law on it, was that there was no way logically that the plaintiff could come up with the evidence because they were out, they were under the influence. There was no way that they could have proven that without a reliance on the inference. And that's why we developed the test for the common law of res ipsa, exclusive control of the defendant, something that would not normally happen in the absence of negligence or malpractice. But in where we have expert testimony.
Isn't it sort of the general rule, subject to exception, that plaintiffs can plead and pursue alternative theories of recovery? And so, you know, you try to establish the predicate fact to get the presumption, but if the jury finds otherwise, then here's other evidence.
Right. And by its very nature, if you're presenting expert testimony, then you're not relying on an artificial evidentiary inference, because your expert is coming to court and saying there was a breach of the standard of care, therefore the jury need not be instructed. You can infer a breach of the standard of care based on the collateral testimony. Now that there's direct testimony from the expert, there's no need for that. And therefore, that's where the prejudice comes in allowing both. And so if we're to say, well, allowing alternative pleading, I don't think that's quite right, Your Honor, because if we go back, especially to Gaffney and some of the common law case law on res ipsa, it says quite directly, res ipsa is not a cause of action. It's a way to plead a fact. It's an evidentiary inference. So I'm not sure that alternative pleading quite fits that and would then say, well, we can have both the evidentiary instruction and the inference as well as the expert testimony.
You mentioned prejudice. Talk about that a little bit more.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear
you. You mentioned prejudice. Talk about that a little more, if you will.
Certainly. So, and this really went unrebutted in the pleading, but I would direct the court to the, I think it's Delta Lines versus Barnes, but similar case law, which basically says, if you change through a jury instruction the burden of proof, that is prejudicial. So where an inference actually shifts a burden, and that was the language of the instruction. If you find these things, then you may presume Dr. Nevins is negligent, and then Dr. Nevins has to prove he was not negligent. That's where the prejudice lies. But also, if we look at just the general case law around prejudicial jury instructions, that the line essentially comes in a close case. If we can imagine that it's likely that it could change the outcome, then the jury instruction, if it's wrong, will be prejudicial. So here, where both we have a shifting of the burden, but two, the unique facts of this case are we already had one jury verdict in favor of Dr. Nevins, and then a second that was in favor of the plaintiff, where the evidence, I think, is finally balanced. That change of instruction, I really do think, is prejudicial, setting aside the shifting of the burden.
So this was a different, that jury instruction wasn't given in the first trial?
You're taxing my recall on the record. My suspicion is that it was given in the first trial.
There was no expert called in the first trial then?
I believe there was an expert called in the first trial. Okay. I do confess, Your Honor, it's been over a year since I read the transcript from the first trial. Sure. But that was my recall. So subject to correction on that, Your Honor.
Was the first trial before the effective date of the statutory change?
My recall is that it was after, but I can't. Again, okay. Subject to correction, Your Honor.
Okay. I don't want to waste time worrying about that.
I do want to address two issues that are not necessarily on the jury instruction, but I think that are important. Of course, if this court feels that the jury instruction should not have been given, then these issues will be moot. But alternatively, we do ask that the court reverse the district court's determination that NRS 7.095 does not apply in favor of the professional entities. Now, this is the provision of the statute which says an attorney cannot contract a contingent fee subject to a complex and Byzantine formula that I still don't quite understand. But the upshot of it was, is something in the ballpark of $1.6 million was applied against the professional entities as opposed to $500,000 against the Dr. Nevins himself. And we contend that the same reasoning that underlay this court's previous decisions in Ferrelli and Zhang should apply here and should be extended to apply to 7.095. And we would contend that the district court erred when it failed to do so. I really can't say anything more than that reasoning should be extended, because although it's a slightly different application of the malpractice law, it essentially gets to the same question. How do we overlay, or how do we interpret the interaction between the professional entity statutes and the malpractice statutes? And true enough, 7.095 does not define the professional entities in a way to fall within that definition of healthcare provider. But in Ferrelli and Zhang, after analyzing how they interacted with the professional entity statutes, this court concluded that the best way to interpret 41A, which I contend is analogous, would be to apply it in favor of the professional entities. We would ask this court to extend that holding to 7.095.
Is there any basis to argue that the liability of the entities was other than vicarious?
It was never pled, and I did specifically look back at the complaint and the jury instructions, and the complaint specifically said respondeat superior, and the jury instructions essentially said, basically, if you find Dr. Nevins was negligent, then the entities were negligent as well.
Thank you.
And that, I argued this in one of my reply or answering briefs, but the question is, if we let this decision to stand, then what is that going to do to the law of third party agency and respondeat superior? And we're going to have verdicts, if this stands, where we have different liability for the principal than for the agent. The better policy, we would argue, which was explicitly adopted in Ferrelli and Zhang, is to have coextensive liability between the principal and the agent. Before I get to the time that I want to reserve, I do want to address one of the orders that we asked this court alternatively to affirm, if it gets to this question, which is the district court's reducing of the damages for the non-economic damages for pain and suffering as against the professional entities. Ms. Martin asked this court to find that Zhang and Ferrelli should not apply, that the professional entities should not get the benefit of the reduction in the damages for non-economic damages. Ferrelli and Zhang already really answer this. I think Zhang explicitly answered this, which I recognize it was not a published decision. But that is the law that the district court relied upon. In their final brief, Ms. Martin asked this court to overrule Zhang and Ferrelli. And what's interesting about that argument is that although she asked it in the final brief, and although these issues have been live the whole time, this is the first time that she's asked a court, either the district court or this court, to overturn these cases. And so I would respectfully suggest that it's waited too long. This argument being newly brought in the reply should not be considered. However, if we look at this court's jurisprudence about when it overturns a case, when it abandons stare decisis, it asks whether the decision that they're being asked to overturn is badly reasoned and unworkable. And it's not enough to convince the court to depart from stare decisis just because a panel of the court or the full court might disagree with the precedent, but instead it has to be badly reasoned and unworkable. Now, Ms. Martin hasn't really gone through those factors in her reply brief, but I do want to look at those two factors briefly. Unworkable. There's been no argument put forward that the decision in Zhang is unworkable. In fact, it seems eminently workable to me to hold to the idea of coextensive liability between the principal and the agent. In fact, I would argue that departing from that precedent would prove to be unworkable, because then we would have, different liabilities for different parties, regardless of their theory of liability, whether it's a principal and agent or otherwise. And then we have the badly reasoned prong. And there's been no argument that Zhang was badly reasoned. Ferrelli was overturned on some grounds, but it wasn't overturned in the main part where the business end of Zhang, as far as I'm concerned, was done. And so there's really been no showing.
Counsel, can I get you to weigh in on something else before you run out?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. NRS 18005 and NRCP 68. And are there different, does the prescription of both the amount, the $1,500 amount, and the number of witnesses in 18 bind a court in any fashion if it's doing a 68 analysis for reasonableness of expert fees? And was Rule 68 appropriate here in any event?
Well, there were Rule 68 offers. It was an unimproved upon verdict, so I can't really gainsay that Rule 68 was properly invoked. What I would say, however, is that if we look at the analysis between 18 and Rule 68.
Let me back up. On 68, the court found that everybody was reasonable. It was reasonable to reject it. The claims were brought in good faith. It was a fair offer, but you know, so that was fine. And then the court really didn't, at least as I read the order, didn't really do any analysis then on, you know, does tie go to the runner, or how do I get from all everybody's reasonable to now I'm going to grant these fees? So that's a question I have for you before we even get to the next level.
Absolutely. Well, in terms of that, the way I read the district court's order was as soon as it finished the fourth of the Brunzell factors, it said, and therefore I award fees. And I did not see an analysis as to how those four factors were balanced, or why the court said, because these two went this way and these two went the other way, I'm going to award fees. That's, may I finish answering the justice's
yes,
question?
2 minutes left.
And so I don't think that the threshold was met in order under Rule 68. I find no real distinction at the business end, though, between the statute and the rule, because they both rely on judicial discretion. And I'll reserve the rest of my time. Yeah.
So, counsel, because you were also an appellant, would you like to reserve any time?
I don't want to reserve any time, Your Honor.
Okay, then. 2 minutes uninterrupted.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Micah Eccles for Marilyn Martin, and also with me is Jerry Gillick, who is lead trial counsel. So this is a case that was filed in 2010 from a 2009 incident where Dr. Nevins performed a revision right total shoulder arthroplasty on Marilyn Martin. And during the procedure, she suffered a fracture to her distal humerus. He then used the Dupuy cement to set the fracture, some of which leaked into her distal humerus and burned her radial nerve. And today she has permanent nerve palsy. So what we're asking the court to do today, when the decision eventually comes out, is to affirm the judgment. And plaintiff's role as the respondent is to affirm the judgment, affirm the award of attorney's fees and costs. No party disputes the order on retax, although it was appealed. And then affirm the denial of defendant's motion for new trial. I'll also note that there was no appeal specifically from the first order denying new trial. There was only an order from the second half of that. That was the juror misconduct order. There was also no appeal from the defendants from the judgment. There is some language in some of the notices of appeal that say, here's what we're appealing from, and then all other orders in the case, kind of a thing. So there is a potential jurisdictional defect under NRAP 3, which requires the order to be appealed from to be specifically taken. And plaintiff's role as the appellant, she asked to reinstate the jury's full award of past and future pain and suffering damages. And then the issue that we just brought up is about $113,000 in expert fees that were not awarded under the statute that we contend should be at least considered under the rule because of the distinct language. Before I go any further, I was not at the first trial either, but we did. The first trial was after the RESIPS amendment. We did have an expert, and we used the same instruction as what trial counsel has told me. So I will go ahead and try to respond in the same order that counsel presented his argument. So in the first one, the res ipsa statute, to basically what they're asking is to retroactively apply the 2015 statute to say that you can't have both the presumption and an expert back to the 2002 statute, which was used at trial. And so page 1350 was one where they waived it. There were also some trial briefs before trial where they filed a responsive trial brief. We filed a reply. They said it does not apply retroactively. That's at 6 respondents appendix 1121. In the motion for new trial, they also said, hey, this statute, there's a line in there that says, although the statute is not retroactive, and that's 12 appellants appendix 1772.
But they were fairly consistent in saying that this is how it's always been and how the law should be, that there's a fundamental inconsistency between going forward on a res ipsa theory and going forward on a theory that requires presentation of expert proof, and that the statute clarified what is and should have been the common law in this area. So I'm more concerned about substance than labels. Is that not advocating for a retroactive application of the rule of law stated in that statute in a clarifying way?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. And what I think it is I think they took two positions. And that's why we raised in our briefs. I think they took two positions.
Okay.
I think they both said, hey, it's not retroactive, but there are some places in the record where they say, well, but we're just clarifying it, which, as Your Honor pointed out, is the same thing in the earlier argument. But even if you say, okay, well, you know, are they allowed to make both arguments? We don't think so. We think that's a Pearson versus Pearson issue. Imagine in trial, if we don't know which way we want to go and we just argue both sides, and then whichever side we lose on, then we appeal the other one. That's what, to use an analogy, I think that's what Roth versus BMW, or I'm sorry, BMW versus Roth were called a back pocket appeal. There's no back pocket appeals, because what they've effectively done, if they're allowed to go forward on this, is they conceded an issue, but then now they're asking for a new trial on it.
Well, how do you understand their objection to jury instruction 24?
Well, there was a time when they started to argue retroactivity in this discussion on the jury instruction.
And they clearly objected to 24, correct? Well, they said it shouldn't be given.
Yes, they did. They did say it shouldn't be given. But here are some of our further arguments on this. So now they're saying that it was just a procedural amendment, but they didn't make that argument below specifically. And then one of the things we've talked about in our brief is the Zamora versus Price case. And the reason we cited that case is because it says statutes are substantive when they represent a legislature's declaration of public policy, which that's what they're saying. Hey, there's this legislative policy of no double dipping. And so that makes it substantive, and therefore you can't get to the clarifying language. Now, let me talk a little bit about the double dipping for a minute. So the double dipping, the way I understand this, is you cannot have the presumption on one hand that there was negligence, which shifts the burden, and have another expert witness who bolsters the presumption. In this case, what we had, we did have an expert, and I'll get into that in a second, the reason why. We did have an expert. The expert didn't try to bolster the presumption under the res ipsa statute. Instead, he just said this is independently, you know, fell below the standard of care. So really, as plaintiff's attorneys filing professional negligence, or we used to call medical malpractice cases, the problem is we had a lot of litigation, I think, that started with Washoe County Medical Center and forward, about even if your affidavit wasn't stapled, it would be a very scary thing for a plaintiff's attorney to file a medical malpractice or professional negligence complaint without the affidavit of merit. And the case we talked about is the Seidel versus Markman case, where the court says, hey, it would be wise to attach this to the affidavit of merit, kind of as like a fail safe. And that was part of the reason why we did it. And it actually came up in the transcripts when we were discussing the motions in limine prior to trial. So we don't think that there's any reasonable...
I'm sorry. So just to clarify, so we said that in case the court determines that this isn't a res ipsa type situation or that res ipsa wouldn't apply, that at least you're not out of court. You have your affidavit to support your professional negligence claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in the case that Judge Weiss relied upon was the Bourne versus Eisman case. And in fact, even at the in limine stage, we still had an objection from the defense on the instruction. They said, we don't know if you have the factual predicate for a res ipsa instruction. And Judge Weiss says, well, I'm just going to have to hold off on that one until we settle jury instructions. And of course we did, because we had Dr. Nevin's own testimony where he said he did not intend to burn Ms. Martin, and he did anyways, and complied with all the elements of the statute for the presumption. So the next issue I'll address is the NRS 7.095 issue. So what Judge Weiss did here in his order is he says, hey, you know, in subpart 4B, the statute has its own definition of provider of health care. And the argument we made, he said, well, Department of Taxation versus Masco Builders, along with a bunch of other ones, statutory interpretation cases, is you apply the specific statute over the general statute. The general statute in NRS 41A.017 does include, as of 2015, does include a physician's professional corporation as a provider of health care. They're not included in this statute. When we're having this discussion with Judge Weiss, he's like, geez, I've never noticed that before. You know, maybe this was a legislative oversight. And I said, well, I don't think it was, Judge, because if you look at NRS 42.021, which the first parts of that statute are the collateral source exception for providers of health care, and then subsections 3 through 8 talk about periodic payments for future damages. In that statute, too, there is a specific definition of providers
of
health care.
Can I just ask you? So yeah. With the statutory interpretation, I mean, we have to read everything together harmoniously, right? So we've held in other cases, Segovia, Zhang, that, you know, we looked at Chapter 89 in conjunction with the other statute to import the professional, you know, the definition of the professional's organization. Why couldn't we also do that here? Because otherwise, you would have different liabilities from the agent and his company, the doctor and his companies, right? And so if the company is vicariously liable, shouldn't they have the same amount of liability? Otherwise, it'll be disparate.
And here's why we don't agree with that, Your Honor. Number one is it wasn't raised in the district court. What they raised was that 41A should apply. They didn't raise Chapter 89. That's a new argument for the first time on appeal. But if you use like general rules of statutory construction, and I've always tried to apply those here, is there's this Witcher case that we cited that says the legislature, when it enacts a law, it's presumed that they have knowledge of all the law. Now, when we applied for fees, we just said, hey, there's this exception in 7.095 where it doesn't apply to the professional corporations. We didn't try to say which version of the statute we're talking about, because it's never been changed. This particular section on not having professional corporations. Now, when the defense comes in on appeal and they say, oh, well, what about Chapter 89 and Zhang versus Barnes and Fairley? And don't we have to do exactly what you're asking, Your Honor? And so our response to that is, well, because this cause of action accrued in 2009, the 2010 filing, we can apply the same argument we had to our Peruzzi argument, that you just look to the ballot materials. Because if you go back to the ballot materials in 2004, it did not include professional corporations. None of the versions of the statute had. And that would cut off the Zhang versus Barnes argument, because what Zhang versus Barnes said is, hey, you know, I think it came out in 2016. They said, well, in 2015, when the legislature put that definition in 41A, we're going to apply that back to 2011. But we haven't seen anything in the briefing that says, well, now we can also put it back to 2004. And so our response would be, if they want to raise a new issue, then our response would be, then we'll just use the 2004 version.
But how can a company be more liable through theories of respondeat superior than the vehicle through which the vicarious liability is just a flow? I mean, I've always understood it should just be flow through liability. So there, you're liable to the extent of the wrongdoer, and then the vicarious liability is the same. I just don't know how you get one who's more liable than the other through respondeat superior.
We did give this a little bit of treatment in our combined brief, I'll call it. And we looked at the statutory language of NRS 89.060 and 89.220, which I think were the two statutes mentioned in those two cases. And so really what it, the way that we read the plain language of these statutes is the holdings of those cases don't track the actual language of the statute. And what's ironic is, in Fairley, when it came out, you know, it applied the law and the substance of the case on affidavits. But then later, I hope I'm remembering this right. I know it was overruled in part by Egan versus Chambers, but I can't remember if it was in Egan or Fairley where the court says, hey, you know, there's this stare decisis thing, and sometimes we get that wrong, but we're just going to go back to the language of the statute. And so if you look at the language of the statute, it doesn't track with the holdings of Zhang or Fairley on this particular Chapter 89 issue.
While we're still on the topic, I was a little concerned about the fee agreement that was entered into. I think that was part of the record in terms of the waiving of the caps that were, the limitations of NRS 7095. Can you speak to that a little bit? I don't know that that can be contracted around.
Yeah, so what we did is we attached the Mendoza order from Judge Crockett, where he held an evidentiary hearing with Robert Eglet's firm at the time. And that went on appeal, but it never reached the court because it settled in the settlement program. But basically what Judge Crockett found in the reason for our argument is that case. Because really what it is, if you look at cases like O'Connell versus Wynn that talk about access to justice, and, you know, quite a bit of that opinion from the Court of Appeals is addressed to the righteousness of contingency fee agreements. And so if you look at cases where you have multiple law firms like this one, we have three law firms working on this case, and to say, hey, we're going to be able to divide up all these fees, and at the time of the application had been 12 years worth of legal work, it's just not sustainable. We can't pay our bills with those kind of a low fees. And so what we tell clients is, here's the statute. We provide them a copy in our fee agreement, and we ask them to specifically waive the statute. Now, that was a fallback argument that Judge Weiss never reached.
But specifically, it says because you believe those are that rule, that statute's unconstitutional in the United States Constitution and the Nevada Constitution.
That's correct,
Your Honor. Two things that you did not raise here on this appeal.
We didn't, Your Honor, because Judge Weiss didn't reach it. And so if you look at, for example, I know the defense cited to the Joe Wirth disciplinary matter. Joe Wirth had a fee agreement that didn't have the specific waiver language where we did. And so that's why we think ours is different.
But if you look at 7.095, it's a provision that says an attorney shall not contract to collect a fee, except as in the statute, in connection with an action for injury or death against a provider of health care based upon professional negligence. So then you go look and see, yeah, there's a definition of professional negligence that lists what that is, and then there's a definition of provider of health care. But isn't a sensible reading of this that it is the human being that caused the injury that you're alleging and seeking to recover damages for? So if liability is purely vicarious, would it not be in connection with an action for injury or death predicated on professional negligence committed by a provider of health care?
So I mean,
to me, it seems logical.
Yeah, so the way we read that provision, Your Honor, in both this case, although we didn't read some of the issues, and in other cases, is first you have to have a provider of health care as defined in subsection 4B.
A human being.
And so if we're suing various individuals, it's going to be kind of a hybrid, right? Because you'll have the physician and the physician's corporation, maybe have a hospital. So it's going to be kind of a mixed bag. But in that same provision, it says based upon professional negligence. And of course, we have the estate of Curtis case that talks about ordinary negligence and professional negligence. And so if you have a case, as you discover facts in the case and realize and you amend complaints, oh, well, this isn't professional negligence at all, then the statute wouldn't apply to ordinary negligence. Now, it does become kind of a swamp when you're figuring out, okay, which fees are attached to which claims. And so what you try to do is you try to classify the whole case as one or the other so we know what we're in for. If it is a case that's purely professional negligence and we don't have corporations, then we have to rely upon.
But do you agree that this is a case of vicarious liability as against the professional and the entity defendants?
It is, Your Honor. And I think there was an admission in the record or an agreement in the record when we were resolving the reduction on the pain and suffering damages. There was something in the briefing there, but it's spelled out in the verdict form because all three parties are just put in there. Was there negligence? Did it violate the standard of care? There's not divided up into different groups.
I want to circle back, and I'm switching subjects back to your comment about Zeidel.
Yeah.
And you were saying that in that case, and I'm going to misquote you, but that it was encouraging people to put in affidavits of merit if rather than risk relying wholly on res ipsa, because you might not be able to qualify for res ipsa. And it struck me as I listened to that if that's the case, and Zeidel long predates these amendments to this statute, wouldn't it always have been the case then that if you're truly res ipsa, the expert affidavit concept would be outside the res ipsa ground?
So
do you follow what I'm asking? Like that they're necessarily a little inconsistent, and that's what Zeidel was holding, which is consistent with their theory that the common law would say these two are separate, and if you're under res ipsa, you don't get expert witnesses.
And I know they did talk about the common law principle of res ipsa, and the way we treated that, we said, well, we're not talking about common law res ipsa, we're talking about statutory res ipsa. Okay. For medical malpractice.
But do you read the res ipsa statute as restricting the common law to only those types of res ipsa? In other words, it narrows the common law but remains a common law concept?
I'm not sure I exactly understand your question.
Well, like if you have surgery and they cut off the wrong leg, like
right.
You needed to have one amputated and they cut off the wrong leg, that would be in the statutory res ipsa, right?
Yes, it would be. But here's the problem that we have. The problem we face is the defense will come up with 12 or 15 theories about why it isn't. And then our fear is we're going to get the case dismissed at the outset for no affidavit.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think my colleague has more confidence in my ability to come up with 12 ways to defend a wrong limb amputation, but there are a couple things I wanted to hit briefly in my remaining time. First of all, there was some argument on 7.095 about the statutory construction of the more specific statute applies. That may be true in a fee dispute between Ms. Martin and her attorneys, but we're not in that situation because the statute is being used to assess fees against Dr. Nevins and his entities. That also resolves the waiver question because my clients never have an opportunity to waive a known right because they were never a party to that argument. Also, if we look at Zhang, there were several things said about the timing of Zhang and whether it was applying to the 2011 amendment of the statute versus the 2004 amendment of the statute. I confirmed this again last night because I also was very curious to make sure I didn't misread it when Mr. Eccles filed his reply brief back in October. And I looked back on the docket in Zhang, and the cause of action in Zhang arose in the last week of May 2011, whereas the 2011 amendment only went into effect the first week of June. Although Zhang in its order said we're citing to the 2011 because that was the then current, there was only one very minor change made to it, adding dietitians to the specific definition of provider of healthcare with no other changes to the 2004 version of 41. It then went on to apply it to 41 because the changes wouldn't have had any effect anyway, and the cause of action in Zhang accrued prior to the 2011 amendment. Ergo, Zhang looked back to the 2004 version of the statute and said, regardless of that fact, we're going to find that the professional entities should be implied into the definition of provider of health care. With that, we'll submit, Your Honors, and thank you for your time and attention to this case.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you. All right, this case.